This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams Israeli airstrikes on Gaza City and stresses attacks strengthen its resolve to fight for Palestinians' rights. Britain records 210 new COVID-19 deaths, raising its total fatalities now to over 70,000. And U.S. President-elect Joe Biden warns of devastating consequences if President Donald Trump refuses to sign a government funding and coronavirus aid bill as a government shutdown looms as well. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Israeli regime has carried out fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas of the besieged Palestinian enclave. In a statement, the Israeli military said its warplanes hit three Hamas targets early Saturday. It claims airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the attacks, which targeted a children's hospital and also a rehabilitation center. It underlined such moves will not break the Palestinians' will, but rather strengthen their resistance and resolve to fight for their legitimate rights. The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip under similar accusations.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and two civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. But we will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resistant groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Now, a year has passed since the assassination of Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. earlier this year. In Yemen, people see his martyrdom as a big loss for the Muslim world, at the same time, new life to the resistance front. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has this report from Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in 2015, Iran has stood by the Yemeni people. General Qasem Soleimani was a key figure in the Yemeni-Iranian relationship with his anti-war stance and support for Yemen's sovereignty.
There was a strong connection between the martyr Qasem Soleimani and the issue of Yemen. He gave moral support to Yemen, which is part of the axis of resistance. Martyr Qasem Soleimani was one of the most important leaders of the resistance, who had a big role in backing countries that confront the global hegemony.
We can see a growing increase of correlation between Yemenis and General Soleimani. For example, the first group of graduates from the Persian language department in Sana'a carried the name of the General Soleimani in their ceremony weeks ago.
General Soleimani is portrayed in Yemen as an important element in the resistance against the Saudi aggression. Yemenis consider him as an example of confronting arrogant powers. He has also become the symbol of a revolution that inspires people to find freedom and dignity.
Yemenis consider him as an example of confronting arrogant powers. He has also become the symbol of a revolution that inspires people to find freedom and dignity. The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani is of course a great loss for Islamic nations. However, contrary to what the U.S. has predicted, the assassination of this iconic figure has given a great impetus to an entire generation that is pledging to continue his legacy while facing the enemies. عبد اللطيف الوشالي صنعاء.
Resistance delegates from Syria, Palestine, and Iraq have come together in the Syrian capital Damascus to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. They praised his vital role in the fight against terrorism. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali reports out of Damascus.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal in Deir ez-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Russia's COVID-19 infections have surpassed the 3 million mark, with more than 29,000 new cases reported Saturday. Virus deaths in Russia also climbed by nearly 570 to over 53,000. In Britain, fatalities there rose by 210 to over 70,000. The country also added nearly 35,000 new infections to its caseload of over 2.2 million. London and other parts of England are now under their highest level of restrictions following the emergence of a new COVID strain. Now that new variant has already found its way to a number of other states despite travel bans on the UK. Spain, Sweden, and France are the latest countries to detect the virus on their soil. all patients arrived there in those three countries from the United Kingdom. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has criticized incumbent Donald Trump for refusing to sign into law a COVID-19 economic relief bill. Biden warned what he called devastating consequences if Trump abdicates his responsibility. Biden said jobless benefits will expire for about 10 million Americans this Saturday. He added government's funding will also end in just a few days, triggering a shutdown which will put vital services at risk and threaten millions with eviction. The U.S. Congress passed a $2.3 trillion pandemic aid and spending package on Monday after months of wrangling. But the U.S. president has called the bill a disgrace and said it will refuse to accept it without changes, or said he will refuse to accept it without some changes. Now, Trump insists the bill fails to do enough to help everyday people. Iran has extended a nighttime traffic curfew to lower-risk cities to sustain a recent fall in daily coronavirus infections and deaths. Spokesperson for Iran's coronavirus task force says curfew has already been in place for more than 100 cities labeled as medium risk. Ali Dazaraic said the measures will now be implemented in 330 more cities with lower risk of the virus. Curfew bans the use of private cars from 9 p.m. until 4 a.m. It came into force on November 21st. Curfew helped reduce Iran's virus deaths from their peak of about 400 a day. On Saturday, the country reported 134 new fatalities and over 5,700 new infections. Both are record lows since start of the curfew. Afghanistan has called on regional and international players to step up efforts to bring peace and stability to the country. Amin Alami has your details from Kabul.
Afghan First Vice President Amrullah Saleh says there would be no peace and stability in Afghanistan unless regional and international players establish close cooperation in this regard. Addressing the second meeting of Afghanistan's National Reconciliation Council, Saleh also said the war in Afghanistan is fueled by certain sides which benefit from war.
Every single weapon or technology used in Afghanistan war comes from outside. So considering the intra-Afghan talks as the only way to bring peace to Afghanistan is naive. We need to take into account the external dimension of Afghan conflict as well, which is highly important.
Afghan officials said they are committed to bring peace and security to the war-ravaged country via negotiations and urged the Taliban to pay heed to the demands of people and approve a ceasefire. This is while a sharp increase in violence has shocked the entire nation and even prompted the UN body in Afghanistan to react. This comes as media workers, political activists and government employees have turned into the most frequent targets for assassination, mainly over the past 2 months. According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, over 50 individuals, all of them media workers, political activists and civilian employees of government, were killed and over 70 others were wounded over the past 2 months. So far, regional and international players like Iran, Pakistan, as well as the UN have pledged commitment to help Afghans in different fields such as peace and democracy.
Governments also have a positive obligation to take all necessary measures to ensure the protection of everyone against violence, threats, retaliation, discrimination, pressure, or other arbitrary action that is taken against them as a consequence of his or her exercise of human rights. There should be no space for impunity.
The calls for collective efforts to bring peace to Afghanistan comes as the intra-Afghan talks are set to be resumed on January 5. So far, the Taliban has not yet approved a ceasefire. Now, many in Afghanistan hope the new round of talks could pave the way for peace in Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Leaders of protesting Indian farmers are set to hold new talks with the government over a controversial agricultural law passed in September. Negotiations are planned for this Tuesday. They follow over 6 rounds of talks previously failed between the two sides. Farmers' Union insists that the laws threaten their livelihoods and should be repealed. The Indian government, though, says the legislation causes no real harm. It says laws allow farmers to directly sell their produce both at regulated wholesale markets and to large traders, something that farmers reject. Now they say the new laws will eventually dismantle the regulated markets. Farmers have been protesting outside the capital of New Delhi for weeks, trying to push for a repeal of the legislation. Now the year 2020 was filled with exceptionally significant incidents, from massive protests to war and destruction. Many people believed ongoing COVID-19 pandemic could put a stop to these events, but it didn't. Let's take a look at some of the most noticeable incidents of the past 12 months.
Australia witnessed one of its most destructive and devastating bushfires in the country's history. During the time known as Black Summer, 33 people died and many more were injured. 24 million hectares of land was burnt, 3,000 homes were destroyed, and 3 billion animals killed or displaced. More than 60,000 koalas were among the animals badly affected by the inferno. Indians started the year 2020 protesting a new citizenship law introduced by the government. The law, which is called Citizenship Amendment Act, gives Indian citizenship to illegal migrants who entered India before 2014 following religious persecutions. The law mentions every religion except Islam. The first wave of protests was held in December 2019 when the bill was passed, but protests continued for the next 4 months. Thousands were arrested and dozens killed, including minors. The rallies stopped due to the nationwide lockdowns the government enforced to curb the spread of COVID-19. A new wave of clashes, the worst in decades, broke out between Azeri troops and Armenian-backed forces in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. While neighbors and the international community called for de-escalation of tensions, Armenia and Azerbaijan kept attacking and accusing each other of provocation. The contested region, home to ethnic Armenian people, is internationally recognized as Azerbaijani territory, but had been under the control of Armenian-backed separatists since the early 1990s, after they seized it by military force. After weeks of deadly conflict, the two sides signed a peace deal in November. After a four-year inquiry, a report on Australian army war crimes in Afghanistan was released to the public. The report, which is widely known as Brereton War Crimes Report, found out that a group of soldiers within the Australian Defence Force's elite Special Air Services and Commandos Regiment had brutally killed at least 39 Afghan civilians, including children. The report stated that 25 Australian military personnel were involved in the killings. The ongoing protests in Hong Kong started in 2019 over a now-shelved extradition law. The rallies that usually turned ugly resulted in millions of dollars of property damage, as well as mass arrests. However, since the government imposed a ban on public meetings to curb the coronavirus outbreak, Hong Kong has been relatively calm. But every now and then, a demonstration erupts. The anti-government protesters now demand complete separation from mainland China. The Chinese government says the United States and Britain fanned the flames of the unrest in Hong Kong by supporting the rioters.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The new data follow the ACLU's warning that America's unique obsession with incarceration has become U.S. Achilles heel when it comes to combating the spread of COVID-19, says Andrea Germanus, writer in an article titled, Analysis Finds 1 in 5 People in U.S. Prisons Infected with COVID-19. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Amid swelling calls to reduce the nation's incarceration rates in light of the ongoing pandemic, the Marshall Project and the Associated Press released a new analysis recently finding that 1 in 5 state and federal prisoners has tested positive for COVID-19 across the U.S. The rate is more than 4 times as high as the general population, the analysis noted. More than 1,700 prisoners have died from the virus, the data also showed. The figures are based on data collected weekly in prisons since March and account for cases and deaths as of recently. The Marshall Project and AP have been tracking COVID-19 data in prisons since March. So far, they found at least 275,000 prisoners have been infected with the virus, though the tally is likely an undercount. The analysis cites Homer Venters, former chief medical officer at New York's Rikers Island Jail, Homer Venters, who said, I still encounter prisons and jails where, when people get sick, not only are they not tested, but they don't receive care. Included in the analysis are 24 state prison systems that had even higher rates than 1 in 5. In South Dakota, for example, 3 out of 5 prisoners have been infected with COVID-19. The highest rate, Arkansas had the second highest prisoner infection rate, with 4 of every 7 having tested positive. The analysis further noted, racial disparities in the nation's criminal justice system compound the disproportionate toll of the pandemic has taken on communities of color. Black Americans are incarcerated at 5 times the rate of whites. They're also disproportionately likely to be infected and hospitalized with COVID-19 and are more likely than other races to have a family member or close friend who has died of the virus. Human rights groups and public health experts have been urging states to roll out plans for the early release of prisoners. Calls began as early as March for compassionate releases. The month since has seen soaring infection rates and prison officials being accused of mishandling the response to the virus and denying basic necessities to stop its spread. Over 200 health experts this month said that prison population reductions would save lives and help limit the spread of the virus to communities nationwide. Physical distancing is unattainable in overcrowded and unsanitary carceral facilities, making viral outbreaks especially likely among a population with disproportionately high numbers of people who are medically vulnerable, the group wrote. The pleas for early releases, however, have largely fallen on deaf ears. In the first 3 months of the pandemic, more than 10,000 federal prisoners applied for compassionate release, the Marshall Project and AP found. Wardens denied or did not respond to almost all those requests, approving only 156, less than 2%. The new figures on COVID-19 infected prisoners align with those of the ACLU, which warned back in April that the U.S. unique obsession with incarceration has become Achilles' heel when it comes to combating the spread of COVID-19. The ACLU has accused local and state officials of failing to take adequate measures to reduce the spread of the virus in jails. And in October, the right groups sued the Trump administration to demand the immediate release of improperly withheld agency records related to federal government's failed response to spread of COVID-19 in prisons and jails. ACLU, along with UCLA School of Law's Prison and Law Policy Program, has been maintaining a death by incarceration database. According to that tool, which covers state, federal, and local jails, as well as ICE detention facilities, there have been 266,993 COVID-19 cases and 1,778 virus-related deaths. In the U.S. more broadly, the virus also continues its grip, even as vaccines are being given to healthcare workers recently. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. has had over 17.2 million cases and over 311,000 deaths. The country's average number of daily cases across a week was 215,729 recently, CNN reported, a figure that's more than 3 times what the daily case average was during a summer peak in July.
Mama, Mama, Mama. spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community. And that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them He chose us. And He chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amirul Mu'mineen said, Al-mayyitu min shi'atina siddiqun shaheed. If a real Shia, a true follower of us dies, he dies as a siddiq, as a person who is truthful. To be Siddiq is very high position. It's so high that even when Allah wants to praise Prophet Ibrahim, He says, وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِبْرَاهِيمِ إِنَّهُ كَانَ صَدِّيقًا نَبِيًّا. Ibrahim was Siddiq. Lady Maryam was Siddiqa, as Allah says, وَأُمُّهُ Siddiqa. To be Siddiq is very high position. Indeed, one of the four highest categories is to be Siddiq. من يطع الله والرسول فأولئك مع الذين أنعم الله عليهم من النبيين والصديقين والشهداء والصالحين. So to be a prophet or Siddiq or a witness or righteous. Of course, some people have more than one of them. So Amir al-Mu'minin says, a true Shia, a true follower of us, the one who listens to us and does what we say, avoids all the sins. When he dies as Siddiq, as a truthful person, and Shaheed. Shaheed either means martyr or means a witness. He can be a witness for other people. People can look at him and learn from his or her life. Sadaqa bi amrina. He has been truthful. Not only he accepted our affair, our wilaya, amr in many hadith means wilaya. Not only he accepted and confirmed our right of wilaya, but also he totally, completely, genuinely tried to act according to wilaya. Just to say, I accept your wilaya is not enough. How much you are ready to change your life your way of making decisions, your way of making relations according to Velaya. Are you a master yourself or you are a follower? It's a big question. If we are masters, then we can do whatever we want. But then we cannot call ourselves Shia. We have to change our name. If we are Shia, it means that we have masters and we want to follow them, because we know that those masters have their authority from Allah and they don't want anything for their selfish reasons.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So a Shia has to be truthful. Inshallah, I will come to this. وَأَحَبَّ فِيْنَا وَأَبْغَوَ فِيْنَا. A Shia is the one who loves for our sake and dislikes for our sake. If someone is good with your master, you must not say, I don't like him because he is not very kind to me. No, because he is close to your master, he's good with your master, master loves him, you have to be kind with him, no matter how much personal, you know, relation you have. Or for example, I say, I don't like him because he doesn't speak my language. His face color is not like me. This is not important. Is he close to my master, is a follower of my master or not? If he loves Imam Hussein, that is enough for me. I should love him. We don't have this right to say, I love this person and I don't love that person because of my own selfish reasons. I love him because he comes from the same village that I come. I don't love him because he comes from another village or from another part of the world, or he speaks another language, or he does, for example, azadari in another way. Or when there is majlis and they want to give niyaz, you know, we give this niyaz, they give that niyaz. These are not the things that should divide us and keep us separated. If they love Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that's more than enough for me to love them. What greater reason than this you want? Someone is a lover of Hussein. I should do everything to make him or her happy. Because he has the highest quality that I am looking for. Is much more important than color, ethnicity, I don't know which town you come from. As we say in Ziyarat Ashura to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Ya Aba Abdullah, inni salmun liman salamakum. It's a very important statement, very easy to say, but very difficult to practice. Inni salmun liman salamakum. I think among hundreds of people who are here, I don't want to judge about people, but about myself and people like me, I'm saying we are going to fail in this test. To say to Hussein, honestly, inni salmun liman salamakum. I am at peace with whoever is at peace with you. Even if he has slapped on my face, I am at peace with him. As long as he is doing good to you. Maybe he has a personal, maybe he doesn't like me. But I am not going to start fighting him. I don't have any time and energy to spend on personal things. If he is good for you and for your community, I am okay with him. And nisalmun liman salam. Wa harbun liman harab. Not harbun liman harabani. Harbun liman harabakum. Maybe he feels I have killed his father. Maybe mistakenly. No problem. As long as he is okay, according to your standards, I don't want to have any personal issue with him. I forget everything. It's very difficult. How many people can say this honestly to Imam Hussein? Inni salmun liman salamakum. Wa harbun liman harabakum. How can Shia take each other to the court? How can Shia, you know, fight with each other? How can Shia damage the reputation of each other? How can they even pray against each other and curse each other, even if they don't express it just in their heart, you know, pray against each other? It's impossible. You must always wish good for other Shia.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of His way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Yemeni Minister of Health says the military onslaught by Saudi Arabia and its regional allies has claimed the lives of over 3,800 Yemeni children in the crisis-hit Arab country. Whilst more than 400,000 minors are acutely malnourished and require urgent care. Speaking at an annual medical conference in the capital Sana'a recently, Taha al-Mutawakkil said children are among the groups that suffer the most as a result of the Saudi-led aggression and siege of Yemen, noting more than half of children in Yemen are severely malnourished. And the military alliance does not shy away from targeting children's hospitals. The Yemeni health minister, Taha Mutawakkil, then pointed to the Saudi-led air attack that hit a school bus at a crowded market in the northern Yemeni province of Sa'dar back on 9th of August 2018. That attack martyred 51 people, including 40 children, saying the strike is a clear example of the extent of crimes being perpetrated by the Saudi-led military alliance against Yemeni children. He also criticized as a great shame the decision by UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres on 15th of June to remove the Saudi Arabia-led military coalition from an annual blacklist of child killers. We now present you an article written by Rosemary Misdery, under the heading, Story of One-Year-Old Abdullah is Story of Yemen. The article was published on NPR.org's website. Please stay with us for more of Rosemary Misdery's article. As Muhammad Yusuf tries to calm his crying son, he says, "Losing my child whilst I'm watching is breaking my heart." He added, "I feel so worried for my son. I won't rest until my son is completely healed." Muhammad Yusuf lives in Yemen. His one-year-old son Abdullah has been at a health facility in Sana'a, the capital city, where doctors are feeding him reconstituted milk from powder formulated for children with malnutrition to keep him alive. Abdullah's attending clinician, Dr. Abdul Malik Muhammad, says, "On 5th of December, he weighed just 6 pounds on his fifth day of treatment for severe acute malnutrition. That's less than one-third of the average weight for his age. The doctor's diagnosis of severe acute malnutrition is a medical classification reserved for the worst cases of malnutrition. Yusuf and his wife, Fadia, traveled 15 hours by bus through dozens of military checkpoints to bring their child to the medical facility in Sana'a, the capital. According to the United Nations reports, in Yemen today, nearly half of children are severely malnourished. The five-year-old war in Yemen has caused the country to plunge deeper and deeper into poverty, poverty that has been exacerbated by floods and locusts. And even when there is food available, a three-year-old Saudi-led blockade restricts goods coming into the country by land, sea, and air. The resulting delays increase the cost of basic necessities like food. And for many Yemenis, any price is too high. Yusuf lost his job as a farm laborer last year when farmers couldn't get diesel required to run the pumps for irrigation and drinking water because of fuel shortages caused by the war. Now his family depends completely on aid, which he says allows them to eat one small daily meal. In fact, 80% of Yemenis are dependent on aid, and it's often not enough to avert tragedy. Yusuf says his two older children died of malnutrition, his firstborn at the age of 6 months, and his second child at the age of 4 months. He says both children died during treatment at a health center near their rural village in Taiz, which he says lacked basic medicine and medical staff. Samuel Mobutu, a nutritionist specializing in severe child malnutrition for the humanitarian group International Medical Corps, says fighting in Taiz makes it difficult for parents to get medical attention for their children. Samuel Mobutu has worked through two previous famines, first in his native Uganda and then in southern Sudan. He says children and conditions in Yemen are much worse because the blockade restricts access to aid. This is his third year in Yemen. During his 9 years of practice, Samuel Mobutu has measured the arm circumference of many children, a major indicator of malnutrition. He uses a small tape measure-like device called a MUAC tape, mid-upper arm circumference. He wraps it around the child's arm like a hospital bracelet, inserting the end of the tape into a slot and pulling it through to adjust to the width of the arm. If the arm circumference is in the range of about 5 to 10 inches, the child is in the green zone, indicating a healthy size. From 4.5 to 5 inches on the tape is a narrow yellow section that indicates moderate malnutrition. Then the MUAC tape is red from 4.5 inches until it ends. When children measure in the red zone, they have severe malnutrition. Samuel Mobutu has seen arms that measure as little as 3 inches around in Yemen. At the 27 facilities where Mobutu manages nutritional programs, he says that nearly all the children he sees measures in the yellow and red parts of the tape. Samuel Mobutu says the signs of malnutrition are evident in their sunken eyes, in cases of diarrhea, ribs protruding in sharp relief, and knees like chicken drumsticks. Mobutu says once the child is sick, their faces show sadness. The mother is also sad. Then you see signs of hopelessness, adding, they don't know what will happen the next day. He says recovery can require up to 2 months of close monitoring and feeding. Other doctors interviewed by NPR have witnessed similar distress. Dr. Wafa Al-Salali leads a team of nutritionists for International Medical Corps in southern Yemen. She says most of the children admitted to their health center are severe cases of malnutrition. Her colleague, Thuraya Salam, a nutritional nurse in western Yemen, says the feeding centers are crowded and malnutrition cases are compounded by cholera and diphtheria. Wafa Al-Salali says, when I see the children in the feeding ward, I'm fearful and worried, adding, watching the collapse and weakness of the health system is the most difficult thing for me as a doctor during the war. At the health center in Sana'a, Dr. Muhammad measures and weighs children during visiting hours. He tells NPR he believes the one-year-old Abdullah with an arm measurement of just 3.2 inches will survive. The doctor says a few beds away is a severe case that he thinks will also survive, a 16-month-old infant called Zayed Ali. After a month of treatment, Zayed Ali weighs the same as Abdullah, 6 pounds. With an arm circumference that measures just 2.8 inches. The doctor has seen an influx of families traveling from distant rural areas of the country seeking medical care for their children in the capital, Sana'a. He says it's a significant indication to him that malnutrition has worsened in Yemen. Samuel Mobutu says even if a child, like one-year-old Abdullah, survives and is discharged from the feeding center, his parents will still have to continue his feeding treatment at home, and if there is a lack of food at home, it is likely the child will relapse. The UN predicts the situation in Yemen will worsen. It projects a famine in the next 6 months, with well over half the country malnourished. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, in a statement last month warned that Yemen is now in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has seen for decades. Antonio Guterres added, in the absence of immediate action, millions of Yemeni lives may be lost. Dr. Muhammad, who sees only a couple of beds free in the feeding ward where he works, for now says the famine already exists, adding, it has gotten worse to the point that it has become out of control. The Yemeni Minister of Health says the military onslaught by Saudi Arabia and its regional allies has claimed the lives of over 3,800 Yemeni children in the crisis-hit Arab country, where more than 400,000 minors are acutely malnourished and require urgent care. Speaking at an annual medical conference in the capital Sana'a recently, the Yemeni health minister Taha al-Mutawakkil said children are among the groups that suffer the most as a result of the Saudi-led aggression and siege, noting more than half of children in Yemen are severely malnourished, and the military alliance does not shy away from targeting Yemeni children's hospitals. The Yemeni health minister Mutawakkil then pointed to the Saudi-led air attack that hit a school bus at a crowded market in the northern Yemeni province of Sa'dar back on 9th of August 2018. That brutal attack martyred 51 people, including 40 Yemeni schoolchildren. Dr. Mutawakkil said the strike, that airstrike, is a clear example of the extent of crimes being perpetrated by the Saudi-led military alliance against Yemeni children. He also criticized as a great shame a decision by the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on 15th of June to remove Saudi Arabia-led military coalition from an annual blacklist of child killers. Dr. Mutawakkil said the previous regime did not offer any medical facilities concerning pediatric medicine and surgery. The high rate of congenital malformation among Yemeni children is due to weapons being used by the Saudi-led coalition and its bombardment campaign. The Yemeni health minister, Dr. Taha Mutawakkil, went on to lambast the UN's negligence, stating that the world body has so far failed to take any measures to save the lives of conjoined twins who were born recently at Al Sabeen Hospital in Yemen. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015, with the goal of bringing the government of former fugitive President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansar Allah movement in Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Aid, OCHA, put the death toll from the Saudi-led war in Yemen at 233,000. The Ansar Allah movement, backed by the Yemeni army, has been defending Yemen against the Saudi-led assault, preventing the aggressors from fulfilling their objectives of an atrocious war.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.